Hello and welcome to another news episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital currencies and helps you understand how digital money and assets will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Jonas and today it's time for another news episode. Today we look to the month of February, so we do basically a review of the most exciting, most interesting, most remarkable news around institutional blockchains. And in this month, I'm joined again by Atakan. Hi, Atakan. Great to have you back.
Hello, hello.
So what will we cover today? There are, as always, a bunch of different topics. One topic will be on stablecoins and tokenized deposits. In February, there was a pretty interesting, insightful interview conducted on the topic tokenized deposits. And we want to discuss a little bit more and understand a little bit more the thinking also of banks when they approach stablecoins and tokenized deposits. Secondly, we will talk about the digital euro. There were some interesting news from the European Parliament. For me personally, also some quite surprising news. Then we talk about tokenization news, which, for example, involve the European Central Bank, but also tokenized equities. We look into crypto earnings because a few players have basically released their annual statements with very interesting results. And then we also look into BlackRock's DeFi move, which I personally also found very interesting. So let's directly dive into it with a quick market overview. How did the market develop in February?
Yes, let me take over here, Jonas. So I think the market was following basically the past few months as well in February. It was quite volatile, maybe a bit more volatile than January, but overall quite a sideways kind of month. If you look at Bitcoin, Bitcoin was at around $89,000 by the end of January. And then went into a fall off. It fell down to about $62,000 by the beginning of February. And it then has moved quite sideways and is now sitting at around $68,000 by the time of the recording, which is the February 26th. So generally, we saw some sharp correction in the beginning that moved into February with a partial rebound actually this week. But in general, quite stable. So other than the correction, in general, the total market cap of crypto had a quite similar movement. So we saw the total market cap by $3 trillion US dollars by end of January, then fell down to roughly $2.4 trillion US dollars now. So a similar movement here as well. The overall macro context hasn't really changed. So we still have some uncertainties. I mean, you discussed the digital gold thesis last month, and I think Bitcoin has still to prove that it is somewhat of a digital gold because at the moment, the price of Bitcoin is rather moving like a risk asset than a safe haven.
Yeah, definitely. And here some stuff needs really to change. And the market has clearly currently not the perception of digital gold when we see it. Because also if you currently look into normal daily, how normal days look like, if gold and silver increases, and so does the stock market, and Bitcoin also increases a little. But on the other side, if the stock market is going down, then Bitcoin is also going down and other cryptos is kind of exponentially or, you know, over proportionally. So definitely not seeing this digital gold narrative here. Yet, question mark, exclamation mark.
This is exactly what I wanted to say as well. But I think that's more maybe our bubble that always says, well, it still needs to prove itself. I mean, it is a young asset in that sense. But at some point, at least, we want to be able to confirm that it actually behaves like a safe haven, right? On another news, maybe a teaser to March, we are getting very close to mining the 20 millionth Bitcoin. We didn't reach it in February, but we'll very likely reach it then in March. I think that's going to be very interesting as well. However, this has no impact on the narrative or marketing of Bitcoin or the price at all. And lastly, just to mention Ethereum here as well. Ethereum has been basically moving just like Bitcoin. So we saw a harsh decrease in price in the beginning of February with a partial rebound this week, and it has moved quite sideways as well. With that being said, should we move into further market developments, Jonas?
Sure, let's go into it.
Good. I brought along a study by BVNK, which is a stablecoin infrastructure provider, and they had quite some interesting takes on the market adoption. So They are stating that the total stablecoin supply has surpassed $300 billion globally, and they are claiming that stablecoins are being used as everyday money increasingly. Now, this is a statement that we've been hearing throughout 2025, but they are backing this with some hard numbers, and they are stating that $136 billion have been settled in stablecoin payments from January 2023 until August 2025, which is a lot. So stablecoins are not just sitting exchanges. They're not being used just to trade cryptocurrencies. Well, that may be the most used use case at the moment. It is continuously changing and moving. So it is being used as real settlement and as a payment vehicle, specifically in remittances, in global payrolls, in platform settlements, and generally in cross-border use cases, which is quite interesting. There's maybe one very important caveat to mention here. BVNK is a stablecoin infrastructure provider, so obviously there might be some bias in this report. I think that's very important to mention when we share these news. So the data aligns with the broad trends that we've been seeing throughout 2025. And this study is proving that. I just hope to see other studies confirming and reassuring us that this is actually true.
Yeah, this was also some kind of my initial thinking on that is always depending. And we know this from, you know, econometrics that a lot of sources may tend to have some biases because it really depends who has, you know, who has conducted them, who has commissioned them. So I also take like kind of every study from the one or the other side with a grain of salt, because others would now say we remember the Visa numbers, right? I mean, yes, there is some real-world adoption, but, you know, most of it is really the crypto, to crypto, the hedging aspect of all of that. But what we definitely see is that there is a lot of momentum of stablecoins. The adoption gets more and more. I guess that's pretty clear and will also be one of the key narrative, again, of also this news episode. So there.
Absolutely correct. And for the ones that want to inform themselves and do their own research, you can find the study in the show notes as well.
Cool, yeah, and that's maybe, you know, when we started talking about stablecoins now, it's of course, again, very remarkable the progress we have seen over the past few year. And I'm often saying that kind of every month we had stablecoin themes and stablecoin topics in the news episode. So be it that kind of leading payment service providers go into the domain, talk about Stripe, for example, later as well. But what we also see on the other side is that the banking sector is kind of looking very closely now to tokenized deposits and is always pointing to tokenized deposits. And I very often get the question, like, what does now the future of on-chain currencies look like? So will stablecoins dominate? Will tokenized deposits dominate? Will they coexist, right? So there is a lot of uncertainty here. And what we should try to do now is a little bit disentangle this, because there was recently an interesting interview by payments.com from the global head of partnerships and innovation at Citi Services at Citi, so Citibank, which I think provides very interesting insights because they are very deep also in the topic of tokenized deposits here. And it provides a little bit more detail on how banks also think about the topic of digital currencies. And of course, it's just one and it's not the average of every bank, but still, I think it's very interesting insights. And what I would like to do now is I brought a few quotes from the interview, which I wanted to discuss here with you, Atakan, as well, because I think it's very, again, interesting how they approach this topic. And then we can maybe, if you know, figure out some interim conclusion when it comes to tokenized deposits. So what he, for example, said is we don't start with the assets. We typically start with our client need, and then we look at the pros and cons of each type of asset or financing instrument. And personally, I think that's a very reasonable approach, an approach we also do not always see in the Web3 space. There is often, you know, great technical solutions, but they are not solving a real problem. So this client centricity, I think, is generally a very good starting point.
Absolutely. Sounds like a consultant wrote this.
Fair.
So I totally agree. I think what's going to be interesting is how you basically position this discussion. Because one could say, well, there is a problem and there is a market gap and there is an asset that actually fulfills this market gap, which is stablecoins. And it's out there. You can use it. Obviously, there are pros and cons. And I think that's going to be the interesting part in finding a path and maybe a compromise on what pros and cons outweigh one asset over the other.
Absolutely. And this may also point already a little bit to the differences between tokenized deposits and stablecoins, that there may be pros and cons for both and not one, you know, being basically completely absorbing the other. And because he also like continues and says in terms of the use cases within the bank's network, tokenized deposits are an efficient way for our clients to be able to get that 24/7 always on availability. So basically a lot of this availability of funds, liquidity, etc., which he sees as a key benefit of tokenized deposits.
I don't know what to think about this. I think it very much depends on the bank's network. I mean, what is meant by bank's network? If you're just referring to your own account or your own balances, I don't agree with this statement at all. I mean, you are able to provide 24/7 always on availability also without having DLT or tokenized deposits, stablecoins, for your own balances. In the end, it's just the database that that is then being updated. So I don't necessarily see how tokenized deposits would improve efficiency if you were talking about a bank's own balances.
I guess it's the nitty-gritty details in the end that matter, right? Because it depends on what you do with it. If you just plug in a tokenized deposit into our, you know, banking system, core banking system, it doesn't solve a problem. If you link this and, you know, bring in automation, for example, via smart contracts, in this sense, then of course it can enhance, I think, liquidity and also the availability. But again, this depends. It's not just the tokenized deposit, it's the whole infrastructure, it's the whole technology, the automation that is happening. But what I think is very relevant in this sentence, what he says is for our clients. So tokenized deposits are an efficient way for our clients to be able. And that's, I think, very interesting and relevant, because that's also one, I think, limitation of tokenized deposits, because it's basically limited to the ecosystem. So it's often the permissioned platform that is only available for the own company or for customers that are whitelisted, and not like stablecoins basically for everybody, right? Because you often have the fungibility issue. And that's, I think, also interesting, because here I think stablecoins have a clear advantage when it comes to the target audience and also the size of the market. Then the next one, and what he's saying is that in terms of tokenized deposits for enterprises and institutions, this promises faster settlement, improved liquidity management, reduced over operational friction, all without introducing new balance sheets or counterparty risk. I guess from what you said previously, Atakan, like, you would be a little bit skeptical, or it would probably be, you know, too short to just attribute this to tokenized deposits.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there is reduced operational friction without introducing new balance sheet risks. That is true. But if we talk about faster settlement, yeah, again, I'm not very, very much persuaded by the statement. They may imply that it's not only about payments of currencies, but they might be talking about settlements, including assets and asset movements here as well. I'm not too sure.
And again, coming back to what we previously discussed, I think it all depends on the infrastructure. So having a tokenized deposit itself doesn't change a lot. It depends on, you know, what is triggering payments with the tokenized deposit. So how much is programmability used, and where do smart contracts play a role? So I do agree with that this is general benefits you can achieve, right? And you maybe even can achieve better with tokenized deposits than stablecoins, I would argue, I could see that point, let's put it like that. But, and this is again also coming to the other aspect that we also discussed already a little, is when he said, when money leaves the bank's network and goes out into the external ecosystem, that's where we see the role of stablecoins coming up. And I think that's something where we are very, very much aligned, that it's about the network size of stablecoins, that it's also that people that are not customers of a bank are not whitelisted can simply receive it, because it's like a bearer instrument. It's not really tied to that account. And it's also like based on a permissionless infrastructure. And this is clearly where I think that stablecoins have a benefit compared to tokenized deposits.
Absolutely. I think it was Rod Garrett in an episode with Manuel who put it best, where he basically explained how stablecoin payments are the most efficient pool payment out there. And I'm very much persuaded by this as well. So it's going to be interesting to see this being adopted by the real world.
And what he mentioned as a last aspect, which I think is also interesting, at least in this dimension, because I often hear this rather in the context of the digital euro, is what makes a currency strong has a lot to do with universal acceptance. And I think that's super, super, super important. And that's also something where the race is not, or where the fight is not completely fought in the sense. Because we know both stablecoins, tokenized deposits, are not a legal tender, so it's different than the digital euro, where you can say, or cash, or you know, other forms of money, where you can say, look, you have to accept them by law. So it's kind of a, you know, market-driven approach to see where you can accept that. And here I'm really, really curious, because we do see a lot of movements in the stablecoin space that stablecoins could be accepted, you know, very, very widely soon, with MasterCard, Visa, PayPal, Stripe, just to name the PSPs, kind of all going into that, right? But I guess this is something, as banks typically seem to prefer tokenized deposit, that maybe, you know, there is it's rather tokenized deposits. But I think that's pretty much open. I'm not sure how you see it. Do you see like a strong advantage for one of the two here when it comes to acceptance?
Not necessarily, no. I think this is going to be a trend that we will see in tokenized deposits as well. Something that we see in stablecoins too is, I think just this month, AllUnity, for instance, has announced that they will be issuing, or they're planning to issue, Swiss franc stablecoins as well, so a new currency. And this is what we see, I think, throughout all countries when it comes to stablecoins, is that we see new and new currencies being marketed and targeted by these companies. And I'm very much sure that tokenized deposits will follow this trend of providing multiple currencies. And then it's going to be interesting to see the liquidities or the liquidity being harmonized between these different currencies on DLT basis.
And maybe to round this discussion up, Atakan, let's compare now tokenized deposits and stablecoins really in the details with a few aspects. So we said in terms of acceptance, it's not really clear yet who has an advantage here. When we come to regulation, we do see, and please, you know, step in if you disagree, is that for tokenized deposits, it currently looks like that no new regulation is needed. This is also something where BaFin recently confirmed for Germany. So it's pretty simple in terms of regulation. You don't need, you know, another regulation. But I would also say for stablecoins, we have the MiCA. So there is a regulation here. The guidance is here. It's in place. So I think there is, I mean, as of now, there was a difference 5 years ago, but now there is not a major difference, because it's both pretty simple, if you will, in terms of regulatory aspect.
Absolutely agreed, yes.
Then we do see in terms of value propositions, we also discussed this previously, is tokenized deposits may have advantages when it comes to own ecosystems, also when it comes to own bank internal systems, as also mentioned in the interviews, while stablecoin may have advantages when it really comes to global use cases, where also the outside ecosystem approach may be relevant. So that also people that are not a customer of a bank, of a specific company, can accept this stablecoin, also in the context of a remittance, maybe, if there is not an underlying bank account here. So I think that's a clear differentiation in terms of value propositions, but also use cases, which also, you know, may imply a coexistence of stablecoins and tokenized deposits.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the ultimate goal here is something that I've been following as well, is in the end, you don't even want your customer to know what he's using. Is it a stablecoin? Is it a tokenized deposit? In the end, it should just be money. It should be maybe a euro that you're moving. And then it should not matter whether it's a tokenized deposit within your own ecosystem, or when it's leaving your bank's ecosystem, is it then a stablecoin? This interoperability and fungibility across these different assets or technical assets should not matter to the end customer, I think. But totally agree. I think with stablecoins, you just have the benefit of having this one shared ledger that just allows for massive efficiency gains and programmability opportunities.
And in the best world, Atakan, I think it's really that the customer shouldn't matter on what the technology is, but also the customer, it's basically all invisible for the customer. So I always like to compare this with the internet, right? We are all using it. I guess only the minority knows how exactly the protocols, HTTPS, exactly works. It's similar with emails, right? So I hope that this discussions, even if we have it, because at this stage, I think it's very important. In 3 years from now, 5 years from now, it really doesn't matter, because you just, you know, you click a button in your app, it solves a problem for you. And in the end, it just works, right? And it doesn't matter if this is a stablecoin, a tokenized deposit, a digital euro, a HOSA, CBDC, whatever. It's just solving a problem for you and you like it as a customer.
Absolutely. I think that's going to be one of the most critical challenges for the digital euro, because you mentioned that, is because it's being marketed as a completely separate asset, which makes sense because it is central bank money in a digital form, right? For the ones that are very deep into this topic, I think we understand. But when it comes to broad market adoption, I think that's going to be a challenging point to actually make people understand what the differences are and how to use them to your own benefit.
Then a few more aspects that are more on the side of tokenized deposits. One is clearly remuneration, because of course people would like to use assets where they can get an interest, because it just makes sense to earn interest, to earn yield. And that's a clear advantage for tokenized deposits, because for tokenized deposits you are allowed as a bank to charge, to get and to provide remuneration, which is for stablecoins or for normal like e-money tokens not allowed. So business model wise here, value proposition wise in terms of remuneration, I think advantage for tokenized deposits.
At the moment, at least, we are seeing discussions in the US, but also we've seen some people here in Europe actually claim that stablecoin should also be eligible to receive remuneration. I think that's still in discussion, and let's see how the discussion turns out.
Another aspect is deposit insurance, because that's, of course, something that is very important for banks, are saying that, look, for tokenized deposits, that may also be part of the existing deposit insurance schemes. So this means if something happens to the issuer, in this case, to the bank, you're kind of protected as an end user, which is obviously not the case with stablecoins. So yeah, I guess that's another kind of advantage when it comes to tokenized deposits. And then the last aspects here I have on my list, and I'm sure it's not complete, so there's probably a lot of stuff missing, but still try to bring some more structure to the discussion, is the Basel capital requirements, because here we also know that as of today, that if you hold money that is kind of based, issued on permissionless blockchains, that this has very severe consequences, basically for the equity that you have to hold against this, so from a risk perspective. But this is an advantage for tokenized deposits, because that's not the case here. However, caveat for stablecoins is that there are some discussions now ongoing to change that for stablecoins, and even some countries, if I understood this correctly, that kind of boycotted the initial rules because they said, no, for us it doesn't make any sense, we're not doing it. So this is something that could change and could become a little bit more neutral, let's say, for stablecoins. So yeah, Atakan, did I miss anything? So I tried to compare this a little in terms of different aspects of tokenized deposits and stablecoins. My personal conclusion is that it's really, there will be a coexistence, and in 3 or 5 years from now, hopefully it really doesn't matter what it is, because it just works in the end, that it solves a customer problem, which comes back to the first statement from the interview that we basically discussed.
Yeah, maybe just one thing is accessibility. I think everyone is, or not everyone obviously, but people that are into the space are able to found a new company and provide stablecoins, apply for a license, and then you're basically a stablecoin issuer. I think when it comes to tokenized deposits, the accessibility is much more challenging. I'm not sure about the details, but I assume you need a banking license in order to also offer tokenized deposits. So it is a more elite club, so to say, when it comes to offering these assets.
Fair enough. And also for you, of course, dear listeners, like, would love to get your thoughts as well on what you think on the tokenized deposits versus stablecoin discussion. So, if you want to let us know your opinion, that would be very relevant and also insightful for us. So you can do this, of course, on LinkedIn to comment on our post. You can join our community and discuss that. So would love to discuss that, because we know there are a lot of great experts, part of our community, that I'm sure have perspectives and opinion on that. Great. So now, after stablecoins, tokenized deposits, Atakan, let's come to a different topic that I personally found very remarkable. And this was that now BlackRock, so basically one of the largest asset managers, or the largest asset manager in the world, goes into DeFi, let's say. So what is it about? So let me make this a little bit clear. The BlackRock US Dollar Institutional Digital Liquidity Fund, or also called BIDL, that we discussed also at a lot of different places in this podcast, is now available to trade via the decentralized exchange platform Uniswap, via Securitize, so one of the leading companies in tokenized real-world assets. So this means that this fund is now basically accessible via Uniswap, so a decentralized exchange. And maybe to get everybody up to speed, what Biddle is again. So it's the largest tokenized US Treasury fund. It's issued by BlackRock. It currently provides an on-chain yield of currently 3.5%, has a volume currently of $2.2 billion. Quite interestingly, the volume also increased 30% in the last 30 days here. So a pretty strong increase, and currently has, I think it's a little bit more than 100 holders here. So we do see we are already in the billion, which is good, but also from a, you know, fund size, there's also, of course, still a lot of potential in terms of the size when you compare this to other other funds that are in from the traditional world. But still, it's, I think, very remarkable how much traction the Biddle Fund has received since it has been launched.
I mean, to me, this is amazing. I never expected this to come this early. I mean, it's the beginning of 2026, and we just saw that BlackRock's Biddle is available to be basically exchanged peer-to-peer in the DeFi world. This is insane. I don't know what to say.
I share very similar enthusiasm, Matakan, because that was also a moment when I zoomed out, which I sometimes try to do, so you're not getting lost in all these news back and forth here, is that if, you know, if you would told me 5 years ago that basically TradFi and DeFi would come so close, and I personally think it's just the starting point, I probably wouldn't have believed you, because I agree. It's really that most of the TradFi companies shy rather away from DeFi, at least as of now, because often these arguments of like everybody can access DeFi, so we don't know the counterparty. So there's a lot of regulatory uncertainty here. What if a sanctions actor is using this? You know, so also from an AML perspective, some challenges. And now, like, BlackRock probably, you know, sees this as well, but says, okay, still, it's a new target audience. We want to provide it to this market. And what you said, I think, is very important, is that it's now possible to trade this money market fund basically on a peer-to-peer basis without intermediaries. And you can basically also hold this money market fund in your self-hosted wallet, right? So you can basically now store like such a money market fund under your pillow in a hardware wallet, right? And that is, for me, something where I'm like also a little bit blown away that this is now really possible.
Honestly, amazing news to see this actually coming to life, and to actually see a TradFi company, as you said, not shying away, not being too concerned with all the risks that most companies and most banks, central banks, have been preaching all those years, and actually doing it and putting it into real life production. That's great.
Absolutely. And also a few fun or interesting insights is that also BlackRock has actually bought some undisclosed amount of UNI tokens. So the governance token of Uniswap, which I found interesting. And the price of UNI just increased. I think it was 25% after this. So I guess not a big surprise. Of course, no investment advice here in the podcast. But that was, I think, a quite fun fact. And of course, there are also caveats as always. So currently only qualified purchases with $5 million US dollar in assets can buy this. So it's not available to all the general public yet. So maybe I have to correct my statement a little, because I don't have $5 million US dollars in asset that I cannot hold it as of now under my pillow in a hardware wallet, but I may be able to do that in the future. Also that the pickup also on Uniswap seems to be rather limited. So at least I checked on a few websites. I couldn't see a lot of traction here yet, but this could also be that the website was not refreshed or anything. So this is just, you know, could be that I'm wrong here, but that's at least something. And when I try to see the actual numbers online, I wasn't able to find a very good information. But this could be either due to the traction is not being there, or maybe the data just not being refreshed regularly. Good. So much to stablecoins, tokenized deposits, and also this BlackRock move. Now, Atakan, let's come to tokenization news, which also includes the TradFi sector and even the European Central Bank for this month.
Absolutely. I mean, perfect segue into the news. Next news bite, which is about the following. So the ECB basically is now accepting tokenized securities as collateral. From March 30th onwards of this year, the Eurosystem has announced that tokenized securities are now eligible as collateral, and this applies to DLT-issued assets via regulated CSDs. There are some conditions. One is that they must meet the standard and conventional collateral criteria, And secondly, and this is a bit of a bummer, is that they must settle via target two securities and are thus still anchored in traditional infrastructure, right? But in general, I think the messaging here and the signal is very important. And it shows that the ECB is looking into how to natively issue and settle assets on DLT. And it's going to be possible, at least in some way, from March 30th onwards. And if you look at this from an optimistic view, this is a milestone moment. I mean, it's the ECB or Eurosystem actually allowing DLT issued securities to be used in real life scenarios and use cases. So we are shying away from the pilot and going into real integration here. But if you want to be more on the critical side, you could say that there's still some traditional infrastructure tied to it, and we still are dependent on legacy systems, so it's not fully DLT native yet. However, alongside with this announcement, the ECB has also announced that it is exploring future eligibility for fully native DLT settlement here as well. So quite an interesting moment to see by the Eurosystem here.
Yeah, and also here, like if you would have told me a few years back that this would be the reality in 2026, I probably would have said I didn't believe you. So I think also it's a very important moment when it comes to tokenized securities. So no doubt, I think it's a big milestone. As you said, it would have been great if you could use all kind of DLT-based instruments, also the ones that are natively issued here. But you know, if you understand how decisions work, how structures also works within central banks, I think it really would have been way too much to expect that being the case from the beginning onwards. So I do appreciate that there is a specific working group now who looks into that. My feeling is also that this is just a matter of time until this is allowed for native DLT-based assets. But yeah, sometimes you also just need to be realistic. So I'm also rather on the very positive side of this news.
Most definitely. We're talking about central banks, yeah. but while we're on the tokenization topic, maybe some other news bite that was quite interesting is we've seen an announcement by Deutsche Börse and XStox. And XStox will now be integrated into Deutsche Börse's 360X platform, and that is a regulated venue overseen by BaFin and ESMA. For the ones that are unaware of XStox, XStox is basically a tokenization platform that wraps stocks into tokens, and they will start with Tesla, Alphabet, Nvidia, and S&P 500 to basically offer their customers tokenized stocks of these in their own 360X platform. So it will be tradable on chain via the regulated venue. And this is a first as well. And for the ones that say, well, how's going to be adoption? Maybe to give you some more background information about XStox. XStox has a trading volume of around $12 billion since their launch and have registered over tens of thousands of wallets. And I think that's very interesting to see that now one of Europe's largest exchange operators is now embedding crypto-native standards such as XStox to offer their customers. Right, so we're not in a sandbox anymore. This is a regulated, real-life infrastructure that is now integrating this more DeFi market as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And also here, we talked about tokenization now for many years. It was mostly about most jurisdiction, at least, about tokenizing securities. Now it seems the next thing is really tokenized equities. Probably as a next step, we will see really tokenized like real world assets, so not financial instruments, but really the assets themselves. But my feeling is this takes rather long. But I'm really impressed also by the news here, and also like the speed actually from Deutsche Börse here with a clear strategy that has digital assets in mind. So yeah, I think, you know, we kind of also have the title for this podcast, Atakan, is really that, you know, DLT takes over but is really now deeply embedded into the TradFi sector. I think that's really clearly the narrative of this episode.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah. Shall we now jump into some of the crypto earnings?
So let's go back maybe to the crypto earnings and crypto bros. Yes.
Yes. Some more content for them as well. I've looked into a few crypto earnings. We've seen Coinbase and Kraken report on their annual financials in February. And I think there was some quite interesting information that I'd like to share here. If you look at Coinbase, just some hard numbers maybe. So Coinbase has upped their trading volume in 2025 to $5.2 trillion, which is a 156 year-to-year increase when it comes to trading volume. And their market share in trading, crypto trading, has doubled since last year. I think this is very big and numbers, and Coinbase can be very proud of themselves.
Yeah, I think market share is really an important number, right? Because for trading volume, it's probably, you know, if the markets are going up and down, which they did in the past year, mostly getting down, then it's not difficult to get a lot of volume, right? But then the market share, I think, is the way more important KPI. But doubling is really not bad, also given that Coinbase is, you know, the custodian for most of the ETFs in the US as well, right? So they really seem to very, very much expand their position globally.
They are sitting at roughly 7% in the global market, which is actually a lot. Mm-hmm. I think another fact that has been blowing my mind, at least, is that 12% of all crypto is custodied on Coinbase. 12%, I'll just repeat again, 12% of all cryptos are held on Coinbase. If you compare this to money in general, it's like saying one bank is owning 12% of all currencies globally. That's insane. That's really a lot.
It definitely is. And my first thought was also like, kudos to Coinbase to make this a reality. But my second thought was also going a little bit more into the systemic implications, right? Because if you have a player that is so dominant in the market, and we do, I guess, see similar tendencies for some like banks as well, right? You, of course, come into severe issues if something, you know, negative happens to this player, right? And I hope that for every company, you know, they do have their stuff together so that this is not happening, right? But I think that's another risk for becoming really, I mean, Coinbase really is systemically relevant for the whole crypto sector, and probably even more because the crypto sector is so large now, this may have spillover. So not saying, you know, that this is like a very likely risk and everything, right? But it's just also when we think where crypto came from the decentralized narratives, you know, no intermediaries, independent of banks, then that's of course also, you know, some kind of a bummer. But of course, also economics of scale just lead to the situation that you have a few players dominating markets. Like, it's just how this all works.
Absolutely. And when trying to basically diversify that risk of this, let me say, central binding to crypto, this is where companies usually try to diversify also their products and portfolio, right? And this is what we see with Coinbase as well. So they historically were very transaction fee dependent and very much dependent of the Bitcoin price. That is still the case to some degree. However, we've seen that volatility has balanced a bit because they have diversified their products. So they gain more revenues by subscriptions, by staking income, by stablecoin revenue. And as stablecoins are basically being adopted continuously, they are able to diversify their risks here as well. Maybe another interesting thing that I basically, from the outlook of the financial report, is that they will focus on three main topics for 2026. One is going to be their everything exchange. So they will just try to be more efficient when it comes to their products. So more derivatives, and everything that comes with the everything exchange. Quite a funny name. They will also try to scale stablecoin and payment infrastructure, something that we've been following throughout 2025. Coinbase is also seeing a lot of growth potential in this area as well. And lastly, they are also want to expand on Base, so their layer 2, and also more DeFi integrations to be able to own the settlement layer as well.
So I guess if you would summarize that would mean that even if a year where crypto struggled a lot, they really had an outstanding year. Do you think this is accurate?
Yeah, I think this is something that you can definitely state here. Again, there's still, you're still tied to crypto prices, right? We still see the Coinbase stock moving similarly to the to Bitcoin prices. However, they are diversifying their portfolio, which is a very good sign because it just gives them more stability in the long run.
Nice. And then besides Coinbase, we've also seen like a competitor, Kraken, releasing their numbers, right? Maybe you can also talk us through some of their key, you know, numbers.
Absolutely. I think it's quite similar to what we've seen with Coinbase. So it's not only Coinbase, the company, I think it's the entire crypto market, at least the more grounded players in the crypto market have seen a similar financial well-being in 2025. A few numbers that are very quite striking is Kraken had $2.2 billion of adjusted revenue in 2025. That is a 33% increase year over year. They've also seen a transaction volume increase of 34% throughout 2025. And that was, for me, one of the most interesting facts is they had over 50% increase of funded accounts and now own 5.7 million accounts with Kraken. So that is quite impressive. It shows that it's not just higher activity per user. So we're seeing an increase in transaction volumes, right? But it's also you're expanding your user base and more people are hopefully adopting crypto. I'm not sure, right, if every wallet is also another person. That is not specified in the report, but at least very likely. Then the revenue was also quite mixed. So Kraken's, I would say one half of Kraken's revenue is basically still fee dependent. So trading based revenues. This is when, right, people make trades, crypto trades, exchanging stable coins for Bitcoin, for example. And the other half was then asset-based. And what Kraken refers to as asset-based revenues is custody, yield, financing, payment, and settlement-related services. So similarly to what Coinbase has been doing, also Kraken is expanding their product, offering now a Kraken app, a Kraken card in collaboration with MasterCard. They have a subscription model. They have a pro version for institutional traders and many other products that essentially diversify their portfolio.
So also in some dimensions, very similar to what Coinbase is doing, right? But in some dimensions also not when it comes, for example, to Base, right? I think that's like Kraken doesn't have an own L2, I think, right? So it's somehow similar, but also somehow different.
That is absolutely correct. Maybe some additional differences is Coinbase is also looking into prediction markets. They are now collaborating not only with Kalashi, but I think they also announced some collaboration with Polymarket. And that is something that Kraken has not been doing as of recently. I'm sure they will follow along as well. And one other difference where Kraken may be ahead is Kraken has acquired Bakkt, which provides the tokenization platform XDOX that we just mentioned a few minutes ago, and are now offering tokenized equities via XDOX. And this is something where Coinbase is maybe not so far ahead. I'm sure they will also look into this in 2026 as well. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that basically summarizes the crypto earnings quite well. So as you mentioned, and I'll just take your takeaway, Jonas, is even though we had not the most positive year when it comes to crypto prices and market movements, the crypto players are still having solid numbers, financial numbers, and are diversifying their product and portfolio, which gives them a long-run stability.
Yeah, and I think really for me personally, surprisingly good numbers. So given that the market really went down substantially in the past year, I was surprised that it was so good. Rather being too good is better than being too bad. So
absolutely.
All fine. Cool, thanks. No.
No investment advice here, by the way.
Yes, we have the disclaimer in the end, and that's very, very important to state here as well. So as the last topic of today, let's go into the digital euro, because there were also some very interesting developments taking place in the European Parliament. And you know from previous episodes that one of the key design questions currently being kind of asked, also, you know, where different opinions exist, is whether the digital euro should be offline only or support both online and offline payments. And we have now seen that this debate is unfolding on two tracks. So one is really the legislative negotiations. So where basically the European Parliament comes up in the end with a clear comment on the law that has been provided, or the law suggestion that has been provided by the European Commission already a few years back. So that's the one track. And here we have seen just a few months ago that there was a push also primarily by the rapporteur that was really pushing for, we want to have offline first and only the online digital euro. If, like, let's say some kind of an objective assessment comes to the conclusion that the private sector cannot really satisfy the needs that are required here, but only the public sector can do. So this means basically an offline digital euro introduction and a conditional online digital euro introduction at a later stage. And here also, when this was published as a draft report, it was clear that there are two camps also within the parliament, and here in particular also in the financial committee, so the econ committee. One camp is favoring really this approach, so offline only and online maybe later, conditional on the assessment. And there are, of course, supporters on the other side that say we need an offline and an online digital euro at the same time here. And an interesting discussion has emerged, because we do see that there are more and more these two different tracks and two different opinions being kind of also a little bit more polarized here. But there was a recent news piece that for me came as a surprise, because I was expecting that this was a rather, you know, kind of close discussion between offline and online and offline. So the two approaches, but it actually doesn't seem to be the case, which I was, for me, was very interesting.
Absolutely. In what camp are you residing, Jonas?
Let me maybe first go through where we stand, and then let us discuss where we stand. It's a good question. I think it's not so simple to respond. So where we currently stand is, or what changed, what is the news here, is that on February 10th, the Parliament adopted basically two amendments of the ECB's annual report. So it's very important to state that this is not the law discussion itself, but it's more amendments to the ECB's annual report. So this is not binding or anything. It's also not really related to the law, but it provides a very, very relevant, let's say, direction of travel where we currently are. So it's a clear signal, basically, what the econ and the parliament think. And here the vote was pretty clear that more than 400 people voted in favor, 160 against, and there were 44 abstentions in this regard. So it was pretty clear, if you will. And what this was basically about is including that a clear signal that the fundamental scope of the digital euro should be online and offline. So it was basically a clear preference for the one camp of the two sides, which is offline and digital euro. And again, this is not binding. There will be legal discussions, you know, on the law, which is ongoing. You know, big fat caveat to that. But it's still politically meaningful, because it signals like strong support for this, if you want to call it like dual mode digital euro, which is supporting an offline and an online digital euro.
Very interesting discussion. I think what also surprised me is that this is now being brought into the public, and it's not being basically finalized in closed doors, right?
Exactly. I think it also in the end hit a little bit more waves than what they expected, because it was just, you know, like a formal vote on a few paragraphs of the annual report, right? But the implications for that are massive. And again, maybe for you, you're now thinking, why are they talking about this so much on online and offline? You know, does it really matter? Isn't this just a technical detail? But it's actually a little bit more, because for offline, what you can do with an offline digital euro is that this is basically good for cash-like use cases. So you can actually enable a higher privacy. You can also have an advantage when it comes to resilience here. So basically meaning that with the offline variant, you can pay without, you know, connection, maybe even as in China, without battery at some point. So it's a important point for payment resilience. Also inclusion, because it's easier to hold, to transfer, like, you know, you don't need an account for that. And this is something that offline can do and online cannot. But I also personally think that online functionalities are very important, because in the end, you need to be able to do this, use this in e-commerce, right? It needs to be interoperable with existing payment systems. In the end, I personally still think that digital currencies generally, and also digital euro, can play a remarkable role in also fostering the role of the euro globally, which I think is a topic that often does not get the attention it should. And this, of course, is not feasible just with an offline version, right? And maybe also if you think about programmable payments, you know, innovative approaches in the end, maybe at some point even AI, who knows, then this is, of course, something that also like an online digital euro, you know, can only serve, and offline would be too short-sighted. Even if from a value proposition perspective, I think the offline one with the high privacy is, at least for me personally, something I would that rather use more, because I'm just a, you know, privacy conscious citizen, and thus also using a lot of cash whenever I can. It was very interesting that it now seems that if you zoom out from this discussion, that again, this is not the outcome of the legislative process from the parliament, but it seems that the parliament is now also in favor for a dual approach. The council also said we want to have a dual approach. The commission in the initial draft also had the dual approach. So just from a political perspective, my feeling that this brings us now very, the likelihood of this dual approach is increasing a lot due to this. And this is also why we brought this up to discuss today. Looking at the time, I guess let's wrap up. Let's come after the digital euro now to the knowledge bites. So briefly, what I brought is the annual letter of Stripe, of one of the leading global payment service providers. And they publish an annual letter every year, which I always found very interesting to read this year. Also, it has a lot of focus on stablecoins and AI, which I enjoyed reading a lot. So if you want to dive a little bit more into the intersection of really traditional payments, also acquiring business, stablecoins and AI, then this is really something for you.
Great. I also brought along a knowledge bite. It's a speech by Hyun Song Shin. I hope I didn't butcher the name. And essentially, he's an economist at the BIS and is explaining what money really is, essentially, in its core. And he claims that money is a coordination device that aligns plans, expectations, and obligations of participants in an economy. It's probably the economist in me that found this quite interesting, but I thought I'd share with the wider community as well.
Perfect. We'll definitely put in the show notes. So yeah, I guess let's conclude. So Diatakan, thanks for joining. It was a pleasure to discuss with you. A lot of stuff happened again here. I think today we really covered everything from stablecoins, tokenized deposits, crypto to the digital euro. So all in one episode. And of course, dear listeners, thanks for joining us. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to our channels, review the podcast, give us a good review here. 5 stars, of course, I always prefer it. If you have feedback, also constructive feedback, please let us know, join our communities. And yeah, we look forward to having you listen to our episodes for next week. In this sense, have a good one and bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.